Good evening, this is Barbara Glickstein.
I'm Diana Mason.
And you tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can find out more about us on our blog, HealthCetera, at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. We produce out of the Hunter College CUNY system, and we're happy to be here on our second segment in a special four-part series in honoring Healthcare Decision Month, because with you, we are going to walk through changing our individual perspective on protecting ourselves by completing the proper legal forms around what our decisions might be in the event that we couldn't speak for ourselves. That includes a healthcare proxy form and other documents that you'll hear more about throughout tonight's segment and the next 2 weeks. Week one, we started with why this conversation. Our guests are Tina Janssen-Spinoza and Dr. Vizette Todaro-Franceschi. Dr. Franceschi is a professor of nursing at the Hunter College School of Nursing. And our guest, Tina Janssen-Spinoza, is a staff attorney at the New York Legal Assistance Group, where she's program coordinator of Total Life Choices, a program to disseminate information about end-of-life planning and also to help you and everyone in the community through this planning process. Tonight, how to have that conversation.
So I'd like to start, and this is Diana here, to just reflect on the first program. Dr. Vizette Todaro-Franceschi shared a story about her own conversation with her father at the end of life and how she took the form, and you invited, Vizette, you invited other family members to sit with you and have this conversation. I didn't do that. When my father was dying, now this was in the 1970s, I had a private conversation with my father. I was traveling abroad. I knew he had terminal cancer and that I may never see him again. And I needed to know how he felt about this being the end of his life approaching. And I sat with him and I asked him, "Are you afraid of dying?" And he said, "No, I'm just afraid of where I may die. I don't want to die in a hospital. I want to die at home." And so I made a promise to him that he could die at home, that I would make sure, I would do whatever was in my power to make sure that he would die, ensure that he would die at home. What transpired, though, was a very difficult family situation because we never shared this conversation with anybody else in the family. And so I did come home to take care of him when my family said, "We can no longer keep him at home. We're going to have to put him in a nursing home." And there was a lot of family conflict in Vizette Todaro and Barbara Glickstein. We are all three nurses, and we've seen these horrific family circumstances when the conversations don't happen ahead of time. One person thinks you should do this. Another person thinks you should do that. And so it was a lesson that I learned about the importance of these conversations. But, it was sort of an early era, and I was new to this. I knew it was important, but I didn't know how to have the conversation.
And for those who've tuned in tonight and missed our first segment last week on Health Styles, you can hear that podcast by going to centerforhealthmediapolicy.com and listen to the full podcast. But don't do it now, because we'd like you to stay with us. You can still be part of this conversation when we talk about how to have the conversation, because I was specifically reminded that Tina Janssen-Spinoza reminded us that we don't need to wait until either we're facing a health crisis or someone we love does. It's better to do it today when you're feeling fully alive and fully yourself, so that that conversation can be had, those documents sealed, signed, and put in a safe place, which we'll tell you more about, so that going forward, in the event something happens, you can have the conversation again with the documents already in place.
So, Vizette Todaro-Franceschi, who are we having this conversation with?
You're going to have the conversation with anybody who's important to you. So you're going to look at your loved ones. You're going to want to have the conversation with them. But I think first it begins with critical self-reflection on, and a lot of places refer to this as a meaningful recovery kind of statement, where you sit down and reflect upon, in the event that you're incapacitated and unable to make decisions for yourself, how do you want to live until such a time as either you recover or you do not? and you die. And so you have to consider that first. And then look around you at your loved ones. You want to have the conversation with them. But in order to choose a healthcare proxy, you really need to look at who is going to act, knowing your wishes, is going to be able to act upon them. So, for instance, if I wanted to assign a healthcare proxy, I have three daughters. I look at two of those daughters, and I know that they wouldn't be able to do what I wanted them to do. They wouldn't be able to tell a physician, I want you to pull the plug. I'm not sure my husband would be able to do that, but I do have one daughter who would be able to say, this is what mommy wants, and so this is what we're going to do. So when you're thinking about who you want to assign a healthcare proxy, you have to think about who's going to be able to do it, make these difficult decisions, and do it in the way you'd want it to be done. Okay, a number of years ago, my husband was getting ready for open heart surgery, and I had to have this conversation with him. And when I asked him what he wanted done, he told me everything. Just do everything. And I said, okay, knowing what I know of the healthcare system, I may not be the best person to be your healthcare proxy. I don't know. So I think we have to consider who would be able to act and do what we want them to do. That's
so
very,
did you
very
agree
important.
To be his proxy knowing that?
I actually did. I agreed to be his proxy because it was very cut and dry at the time. I want everything done, and if you want everything done, I can do that. But was it easy for me as a healthcare professional to say that? No. But again, it's about the person, and it's about their wishes. And if we can just get that point across, that this is about us individually, how we want to live until such a time as we either recover or we do not. And if we look at it that way, you know, when I teach this topic, I say to my students, I could leave here tonight and get hit by a car. If I don't have a healthcare proxy on me, they're going to call my next of kin. They better have that, because that's who they're going to call. But that next of kin may not be my healthcare proxy, right? There's so many things that we have to consider, and those are the things I think we're going to get into in the next couple of weeks.
And I really appreciate your telling me whether you decided to accept that responsibility in the situation with your husband, because I think it also reflects that the person who you asked to entrust the decisions that you want for yourself, that may not be the same decision they make for themselves, will still respect and you trust that they will make the decision that you want. And that's part of the decision-making process of who your agent to make those decisions for you. Because I'm in a similar situation where there are people in my family who would not make decisions that I would want, but I would trust they would do it on behalf of my wishes.
Mm-hmm. And there's things that, you know, physicians won't tell you, and that is that you don't have to assign one person to make decisions. Mm-hmm. You can have more than one person be involved in the decision-making process. But that's a little tricky, because if you get more than one person involved in the decision-making process, they all have to agree. And so the conversation still has to take place beforehand. You're shaking your head no.
Yeah, I know. I'm not agreeing with that at all. I'm not agreeing with that at all. In theory, that would be a nice idea. But I actually think, I mean, one of the reasons that we do these documents is to be sure that, I mean, obviously that our wishes are going to be honored, but also to make sure that there are not going to be any conflicts or any courts involved or any ethics committees of the hospitals or anything like that that's going to be involved. The way to do that is by appointing one person at a time. And the New York State form does ask that you appoint one person at a time. I do not accept people that appoint, for instance, it's often my son and daughter-in-law. And I'm kind of like, but wait a minute, but what happens if they get a divorce? Oh, they're not going to get a divorce. I don't know that. We don't know that. We don't know what the future is going to hold. So what might potentially happen is that the son and daughter-in-law, let's assume that I'm going to let them do this, which I would not. But let's assume something happens to them and the healthcare proxy gets called upon, the healthcare proxy document gets called upon, and they see son and daughter-in-law, and they start arguing. And they're both on the same rank on the healthcare proxy. My number one choice is my son and my daughter-in-law. Then who are the doctors supposed to listen to? if the son and the daughter-in-law, my both number one healthcare proxies that I've put on the same equal footing to make medical decisions for me, who are the doctors supposed to listen to? They're not going to know. So they're not going to listen to one or to the other one. What they're going to do is they're going to say, we're not getting involved. The hospital is not going to want to get involved. And they're going to say, you go hire attorneys and deal with that in the court, and then we'll listen to what the court has to tell us. So that's, for me, definitely not something that I would accept or that would work.
So let me just ask you. So because I came from the same place as Vedette. I have a healthcare proxy with two people. One, and I'll tell you why, one has to do with the burden that people feel of making the decision on making decisions on their own. So I have a husband who would do whatever the physician said to do. And he needs to have backup, knowing that that's not the voice to listen to. The voice to listen to is the voice that I have had the conversation with my friend who understands what my voice was too and what my wishes were. There is this, I think there's a component of this about, these are tough decisions. These are, I mean,
very tough decisions.
But I think that we are, I mean, I think that we're once again talking about a situation where we are dying, whereas I understand that we also need to take that into consideration.
Right.
I'm thinking more about where we're not dying, and we're in the hospital,
okay,
and we need a strong advocate, and we need to make sure that we're going to have somebody who is going to be calm and responsive and be able to make decisions,
mm-hmm,
and be able to be called at 3 o'clock in the morning should the need be. If you are in a situation, and going back to if we're in a terminal irreversible situation, in other words, we have started the active dying process, then in that case, I would appoint, in your situation, Diana, I would have just appointed my friend.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And not my husband. But I would have made, I would have, of course, explained why.
So how do we have these conversations? Knowing that to sit down with my husband who doesn't even, regardless of whether he's going to be my healthcare proxy or not, but to have a conversation with somebody who really doesn't like to talk about these things, how do I enter this conversation?
And the conversation we're talking about is you're listening to Health Styles. I'm Barbara Glickstein.
I'm Diana Mason.
And today we're talking about the conversation to have with your loved ones, your friends, family, partners, spouse, adult children, about who and how you will assign a healthcare proxy and what your wishes are about the way that you would like things to be managed in the event you couldn't speak on your own behalf at a time of health crisis where you needed to have others make decisions for you. So now, how do we have that conversation?
I think you start by making it personal. It works, and I've done this with thousands of students, but I've also done it with patients and with loved ones and with my own loved ones, to give scenarios, to give little cases. What if?
Give us one.
What if? What if you were in the hospital for voluntary surgery on your elbow and you didn't recover from the anesthesia? You coded, stopped breathing, they resuscitated you, and you are now on respirator, dependent on machinery to breathe. And what if that were to occur? Would you want to be kept alive on a respirator? And in an ICU with invasive treatments, in the event that this should happen, and they believed that the prognosis was poor for you to fully recover. What if?
So I'll play the family member. You just laid that out to me, and I'll be the family member who's resistant to this to the nth of the world. That's not going to happen. We always choose really good practitioners and good hospitals. And you're only 34. So why are we having this conversation? Let's go watch the ball game.
You know, I would lean back on the classic cases. I would go to Quinlan, who was 21, overdose. Or I'd go to Nancy Cruzan, who got in a car accident at the age of 26. Or I'd look at Terry Schiavo, who probably was bulimic, although we'll never fully know why she coded arrested. None of them did we expect, did their families expect, did they expect would be in those circumstances where they would no longer have a quality of life and where there would be all this trepidation as to how do we act in their best interests and how do we provide them with quality caring in the event that they were unable to do anything for themselves. So the conversations didn't take place. So we don't know. I mean, there's no guarantees. You could be diagnosed with cancer and have a miraculous spontaneous remission. It happens all the time. We could be fine one second, and the next minute we could be struck by lightning. We don't know. So it's better to be safe than to be sorry. It's better to have the conversations while you can. And it also lessens the burden on our loved ones, that our loved ones don't have to sit there and struggle with, should I, would I, could I do things differently? How should I do them?
So I'm wondering if there's data that supports a good time of the year or a good kind of scenario. So you've presented a conversation where perhaps people are sitting around a dinner table or it's at night and the TV's on or they're taking a walk on the beach in the summer. For some people, they may know those moments with their loved ones, and for others, they may be saying, I have no idea how to slip in this conversation. My family doesn't want to talk about this.
You know, I have in my class, I have a class that I teach regularly called Changing the Face of Death, and I use motion pictures and case scenarios and personal accounts. I have students sharing accounts. Some of the students in the class are non-nurses and non-nursing majors, and some of them are nurses. So many different stories. One of the stories I absolutely love, and I know that it's life-altering for students, go sit down and watch Tuesdays with Maury with your loved ones. And then talk
and
about it.
Tuesdays with Maury.
Tuesdays with Maury. There's a documentary, too, with Ted Koppel, I believe. You can watch it.
Mitch
Albom is the author. And sit down and make it a family night, a movie night, and then have a conversation about that movie. It works to start people off thinking about, wow, I mean, this is a man who had his own funeral before he died, so that he could have everybody say nice things to his face instead of the gravesite, you know. Why not?
Tina Jansen Spinoza, what do you tell people about how to start the conversation?
Well, what I hear a lot is I hear parents that tell me my kids don't want to hear, listen to me. And then I have the kids tell me my mother or father doesn't want to start the conversation. And then when you were talking about, it's not going to happen to you. You're going in for elective surgery or you're going in for whatever surgery. It's not going to happen to you. So I think that as human beings and to our loved ones, our first instinct is to reassure, because we might be thinking that the person who's going to go into surgery is seeking reassurance. So maybe by saying, I'm not looking for reassurance, I'm quite sure, that the operation will go well. But just in case, we still need to discuss this. Another way of starting the conversation is by saying, I heard a radio show the other day or the other night, and I really feel that we need to talk about it. And maybe also by keeping in mind that the people that you're going to be talking to while you are making the decision about who is the right healthcare agent for you is also going to be somebody over the age of 18. So is also somebody who's going to need a medical advance directive, a healthcare proxy, or whatever it's called in your state, healthcare power of attorney or whatnot. So you're going to be helping yourself, and you're also going to be helping that person, because that person also needs to complete the documents. What I would keep in mind also, as you try to plow forward and maybe get over the reluctance of the people that you're talking to, is the documents, by signing a document like this.
Advanced Directive Healthcare Proxy Form, which we'll talk more about next week.
It's a way of empowering yourself. So it's not because you're not able to communicate that your wishes should not be honored. So you're basically putting them on paper by designating somebody else. So don't let go of that power that you have right now while you're able to talk, and put things down on paper and make sure that the person in front of you is going to take the time to listen. But I think it's about everything has to do with communication. You just need to communicate what your needs are at this point in time. I do not need reassurance. What I need right now is I need you to listen to me because I need to be able to count on you. That, I think, needs to be, and kind of like cutting short all the, oh, it's going to be okay, don't worry about it, because that's not the conversation that we need right now. We maybe need that for later on, but not for now.
And I want to point out that actually, and this is on HealthCetera, on a blog post that I wrote for our blog for the Center for Health Media and Policy a couple weeks ago, that Susan Block is a psychiatrist, a professor of psychiatry and medicine at Harvard Medical School, and she has come up with four questions to guide end-of-life conversations, which is taking that extreme position of we're talking about this when you know you're having a terminal illness, which is different than, Tina, I think what you're trying to instill in people, don't wait until you have that diagnosis.
If you're 18, do one.
Right.
If you're 18,
right. Do one. But she raises four questions. One is, what do you know about your prognosis, which that seems like it's one that a healthcare provider might want to ask. So if I'm a nurse and you're the patient, I know you're terminally ill, to start the conversation, I might start with, what do you know about your prognosis? Second, what are your fears? And that's certainly the question I was interested in with my father. Was he afraid of dying? And he talked about what he was not afraid of, but as well as what he was afraid of. How do you want to spend your time? And that's, again, I think that understanding of it's about how we're living with the time we have, not just how we're dying. And the other is, how much suffering would you be willing to endure if it offered the possibility of more time? So, Vedette, talk about the trade-offs here, suffering versus more time.
The person I think of when you talk like that is Ira Byock. He wrote a book, an absolutely wonderful book called Dying Well, which I highly recommend to people to read. And in it, he gives his own journey into palliative care. He's a physician and one of the founding leaders of the palliative care movement. And he begins with the story of his own father, who was diagnosed. But then he goes in each chapter, he shares different scenarios of different patients. And the one, and I may be misquoting him because it's a while since I picked up the book, but he spoke of a young woman who was diagnosed with a terminal illness. And he thought his conception of her ability to persevere and fight this disease, because she was young, because she had a young family, and he thought her prognosis is so poor, we should go for palliation. But her feeling was she wanted to fight. She wanted to fight tooth and nail, and she didn't care about suffering. She didn't care as the disease was progressing, the treatments were becoming more aggressive. She wanted every available moment of her life. And he finally realized, wow, this is not my perception of what dying well is, but it's hers, and it's her choice. And that's a very hard thing for a healthcare provider, and that's why we have a very big problem with prognostication in healthcare. Physicians don't want to give a poor prognosis, and so they're more likely to give, and all the more reason to do it when you're well, to do it when you're a young adult, to start to think about it, because physicians and nurses and healthcare providers are human beings too. And we're still at a point where we think that it's a failure. When people are dying, it's a failure of the healthcare system, when in fact it isn't. Everyone is going to die. So prognosis shouldn't be a deciding factor in completing these advanced directives or healthcare proxies and all the different kinds of forms we'll talk about next week. But that we consider whether or not we would just think about whether or not you'd want to live on a respirator, whether or not you'd want to suffer with different kinds of treatments, if it were worth it to you.
So I want to go back to a great quote that Tina said, which is, if you're 18, complete one. Think about it as a driver's license. It's going to give you and take you to places that you want to go, that will allow you to make have someone make decisions for you. So this is going to be your bucket list. Put it on your bucket list. Today we talked about why have the conversation with our guest, Dr. Vedette Todaro-Franceschi, who's an RN and a professor of nursing at Hunter College School of Nursing, City University of New York, and Tina Jansen Spinoza, staff attorney at New York Legal Assistance Group, where she's the program coordinator for Total Life Choices.
Now, next week, we're going to be walking you through a health care advanced directive and health care proxy form, and we want you to have a form in front of you. Now, you can get any form, and Tina and Vedette, give the websites again where they can get one, but then, Tina, I want you to give the website that has the form that you're going to actually use. Not that they have to have that form, but if they want to have the exact form you're going to use, we can walk through that.
The exact form would be at totallifechoices.org, and you can just download the form. It is also extremely similar to just the New York State form that you can find on the New York State website.
So totallifechoices.org.
And caringinfo.org is another website that you could go to for state forms.
Great.
The different states.
And for a repeat of this program and week one, where we talked about why have the conversation, you can go to the Center for Health Media and Policy's blog, HealthCetera, at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com, where these podcasts of last week and this week's program can be heard and spark the conversation with those who you want to have this conversation with. I'm Barbara Glickstein.
I'm Diana Mason.
And you've been listening to Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You've been tuned into WBAI. Stay tuned, and we'll see you next week.